My lords, ladies and gentlemen, this afternoon our panel are talking about empires. Tom Holland, historian of ancient empires, co-presenter of podcasts, The Rest is History. Helen Thompson, professor of political economy at Cambridge University and co-presenter of the podcast These Times. And Ali Ansari, professor of Iranian history at the University of St. Andrews and an alumni of The Rest is History. So they need no further introduction, and I think Helen is going to kick off.
Well, it's an absolute pleasure to see so many of you here this evening. We want to talk about empires, but we don't really want to talk about any in particular, except in the context of trying to think about why we need to think about what empires are and their place in world history. Now, obviously, we live at an age in which the word empire has got lots of very negative connotations to it. In lots of ways, we live in a, or at least we like to think that we live in a post-imperial world. But it's not entirely clear, at least I think to all of us, that that is true. And I think we're going to get to trying to think about the present, but we want to start in the past. And I want to start asking Tom a question about where the word empire comes from and whether there were empires that we would think of as empires before there was actually this word empire to describe them.
So the our word, English word empire, comes from the Latin word imperium. And imperium initially means the power that is exercised by a Roman magistrate in the days of the Republic, before autocrats follow on to emerge from the destruction of the Republic, so the rule of the Caesars. So before the coming of the Caesars, a Roman magistrate would be elected and he would be endowed with imperium. And he would exercise that imperium over his fellow citizens. But if he is appointed to a military command or a provincial command, he would exercise his imperium over foreign peoples. And the idea starts to develop that Rome herself exercises an imperium over the countries of the world that have submitted to Roman power. And over the course of the centuries, the idea of a power that is exercised in the abstract comes to be associated with a physical dominion. So imperium comes to mean what we would call empire. The imperium Romanum means the Roman Empire. And it reflects a deep-seated Roman assumption that imperium is something that they have been given by the gods. And the gods have given it to the Romans because the Romans are the most pious and dutiful of people. And the evidence for this is that they have a massive great empire. So it's a completely circular argument, but a genius argument. And it's one that will be recycled by many empires that follow. Because I think that for a broad swathe of peoples in the western half of Eurasia, the Roman Empire is the archetype of empires. So when the Roman Empire splits, three successor notions of empire emerge from it. There is the Western notion of empire, and I think you could define the West as being those countries that are interested and admire and have historically attempted to emulate the pre-Christian Roman Empire. Then you have Byzantium, which stands in a direct line of continuity. The Byzantines called themselves Romans right the way up to the fall of Constantinople and the conquest of what remained of the Roman Empire by the Turks. And then you have Islam, which to a degree that is, and how much is highly contested, but the Romans provided a model. The Umayyads, the first Islamic dynasty, were accused by their critics of aping the Caesars. So to an extent, Rome provides the model, but I'm sure that people on this panel who may or may not be of Iranian descent may be arguing that before Rome there were other models of what we might call empire. But just to put on record that it is the Romans who give us our name in English. But ultimately, Ali, everything comes from Persia,
well, doesn't that's it? Right. That's right. Yeah. I was wondering where you were going to go with that, and I agree entirely with Tom about the origin of the word. But in terms of the development of an idea of universal empire, clearly, and the term itself is obviously so. I mean, what we describe as an empire throughout history is very varied. I have to say, I mean, it's very difficult to pin down exactly what we would describe. Or you know, define as an empire. But to sort of slightly paraphrase from sort of Kenneth Clark, we can't really define it, but we know it when we see it. And I think the Persian Empire and the first of the three ancient Persian empires, I think, offers a very clear template of an empire structured. And I think Tom will agree with this because I've slightly poached it from him, actually. So hopefully he will agree.
I probably will agree with
him. I know, I think you will. this idea of an imperial authority, actually, which is quite interesting. So the Roman Empire has clearly is very effective both as a sort of a moral and a military sort of structure. I think the Persian Empire never really had a standing army, the ancient Persian Empire, in the same way that the Romans were able to develop. But what they were able to do in order to establish their hegemony over much... you know, the vast swathes, obviously, of what we now know as the Middle East and Central Asia, was a sort of a moral authority, which I think is quite interesting. Of course, that doesn't mean that they were necessarily good or bad or wicked or whatever. It's just this idea that they had a concept of themselves of having that sort of moral superiority that allowed them to exercise dominion over other peoples. And the other distinctive thing, I mean, I think with the Romans is quite different, of course, where they offer citizenship to other peoples in the empire. The Persians don't, actually. I mean, the Persians have a structure of empire that comes from essentially the Iranian peoples being the number one peoples of the empire and then sort of moving outwards. I mean, they sort of look at Iran and non-Iran and then extend outwards. The further away you are from the centre, the less important you are, frankly. I mean, that's basically the way they look at it, until we get to the Greeks, obviously, yeah. Who are really the least important and most irrelevant. But we'll let others discuss that.
But, OK, I want to press both of you on then something in this respect, is if we think about the ancient world, that's starting actually quite late in the sequence of empires with Romans and Persians. Well, Persians before Romans, but nonetheless... what was the way, say, the Egyptians thought about what kind of territorial political entity that they had? And are they, because they didn't have an idea, either in the Roman sense or in a Persian sense, of universality, are they something different?
They do have a kind of idea of universality, the Egyptians, but the Egyptian sense is that the land of Egypt is everything, and that the peoples who lie beyond the land of Egypt... are kind of irrelevant, and so you can conquer them if you want to. But if you don't, it doesn't disprove the fact that Egypt is the centre of the universe. And the kind of almost the... So the Narma palette, it's called, it's an image of the first pharaoh of the two kingdoms of Egypt, the United Kingdom of Egypt, Upper and Lower Egypt. And it shows him walloping a foreigner. And this is... this is a kind of expression of pharaonic power, and therefore, by extension, Egyptian power, that runs right the way through Egyptian history. And they feel that, you know, if they need, you know, if they're having incursions from Nubia or from Palestine or wherever, then they have the absolute right to go out and pulverize them and conquer them. And there are kind of occasional periods where Egypt does kind of try and establish an empire, perhaps in the more Roman sense. But the other template in the Middle East, which Persia is absolutely building on, are the Mesopotamian empires. And the figure who traditionally by Mesopotamians is held to be the leader of a city that conquers and annexes other cities is a guy called Sargon from a place called Akkad. And this idea, because Mesopotamia begins a bit like Greece, it's a kind of lots of little city-states, but Sargon has this project of going out and conquering other cities and making them tributary and subordinate to Akkad. And although the Akkadian Empire does not last very long, the memory of him endures and provides an inspiration to the Assyrians and to the Babylonians. And because the Babylonians provide a template to the Persians for what power should be, you can see that Persian rule is drawing on that line of inheritance as well. And because I think what Ali mentioned, what Persia introduces that had not really been present in any of the earlier empires is an abstract sense of good and evil. The idea that the universe is, that, you know, there are rival poles of truth and the lie, of order and disorder, that is cosmic in its implications. And this is a kind of genius initiative because it, in a way, denationalizes it.
Yeah.
For the Egyptian kings or the Assyrian kings, there's this automatic assumption that goodness and order are associated with Assyria or with Egypt. The Persians are still doing that, but they're broadening it out and saying that the whole universe is governed. And therefore, to be on the side of order basically gives you the right to conquer absolutely everybody. Mm. And by extension, it means that anyone who opposes you is evil. Is the embodiment of the lie.
The lie.
And this is incredibly fertile, incredibly kind of momentous innovation, because it looks forward to the kind of empires that you will get in the Christian and the Muslim worlds. And we haven't even got on to China.
I know.
Ask some follow-up from that, to ask something to Ali. What then was political evil in that conception of like good and evil? So if empire is the way that you do politics, what was it like, what did it mean politically not to be in an empire? Did they have anybody here have a coherent alternative of another form of political organisation?
So, I mean, one of the things, if we're looking at the pre-modern world in particular, I mean, empires are ubiquitous. I mean, this is the thing, we live in a world...
city-states, I mean, I'm going to...
Well, the nomadic powers.
The nomadic powers are there. So what you have is, you have, so in the Iranian sort of heritage, you obviously have the imperium, to borrow a phrase, obviously, but the imperial heartlands, and then, you know, beyond the pale, effectively, and that's essentially what it is, are the nomadic tribes that exist beyond that, particularly in Central Asia and elsewhere. Of course, you know, when we get onto that, there is a period when the nomadic tribes themselves then start to establish hegemonies and imperiums vis-a-vis the Mongols and others. But it's interesting that there is this divide between, and you see this in the Muslim world as well, of course, between the abode of order, in a sense, and the abode of disorder. And those people operating beyond that pale are... yes, they provide an alternative means of political organization, but from the perspective of the empire, obviously, they represent chaos. I mean, they represent that which is not good, certainly. And of course, in the Persian experience, they are periodically invaded by these nomads, of course. And what they tend to argue is that actually, and this is obviously a post-facto argument, when you have been conquered by the nomads, they then say, but this is just an injection of new blood and it will get things going again and we'll sort ourselves out. So basically the nomads come in, they settle, and they become the new hegemon in that sense. I mean, they borrow in. I mean, one of the things that Tom said, I'll just say this, which I think is very important in terms of understanding, is this sort of legacy and memory of empire is extremely powerful. I mean, it is extremely powerful. Going back to, obviously, the Mesopotamian heritage, but it's this idea that successive states seek to emulate those imperial predecessors. Yeah. And that's very striking.
But because I think we assume that empires are bad and that no one would want to be a part of an empire. But the greatest empires are those that convince those that they've conquered that it's for their benefit to be part of that. So the Roman Empire, you know, by the beginning of the 3rd century AD, every free male in the empire has become a citizen, which is why people can think of themselves as being Roman, whether it's in Cumbria or in the fringes of Arabia. And I suppose the most spectacular example of this would be China, where the first emperor, Huang Jidi, is in the 3rd century. His genius is to unite 7 warring kingdoms and to convince the people in these warring kingdoms that from this point on... the unity of these kingdoms in a single empire is what the heavens require.
Yes.
The image of the heaven is to be found in this ordering. And it means that the Chinese can sustain a sense of continuity from the 3rd century BC, right the way I would say up to the present day, because it's amazing that Xi Jinping, despite leading a communist state, is a huge enthusiast for the first emperor. There are all kinds of TV programs, films about him, all kinds of stuff. And I think that he can do that because the idea of the empire as a bulwark against everything that is terrible, the disorder, the disharmony, is so powerful that even those who threaten it, as Ali said, so, you know, the barbarians who break through the Great Wall and on occasion come to rule as dynasts, end up buying into this ideology. And there's a sense also in the West that the successor states to the Roman Empire are doing the same. Yeah. But I think for kind of geographical reasons, the fact that the Mediterranean and Europe is much more geographically fragmented, we do not now live in a Romania, a successor state of the Roman Empire, in the way that the Chinese do in China. But for millennia, people in the West were haunted by the memory of the Roman Empire and have tried to restore it. And the idea that that empire is ipso facto evil is quite a kind of late idea, I think.
I'm going to push back on this a bit against this ubiquity of empire in Europe. I take entirely what you say, and that I think that the Western imagination is haunted by Rome. But couldn't you also say that in lots of ways, the West culturally has been formed by Jerusalem and by Athens? And I think you would not disagree with either of these, Tom.
No, I would not.
And at the core of what Jerusalem became imaginatively and at the core of what Athens became imaginatively was something very anti-imperial. I mean, Israel...
Well, except that Athens, of course, does come to rule an empire.
I know, but it starts off as asserting themselves against the Persians. This is another form of political organisation. It brought what we like to think of as the idea of democracy associated with the city, and Israel, the ancient Israelites, were constantly trying to defend themselves against these imperial powers, and we have that legacy too.
So just on Athens, Athens is the great protagonist in Herodotus' account of the Greek struggle for freedom against the exactions of the evil Iranian imperialists. But Herodotus knows, as he's writing it, that Athens herself is a successor empire, that Athens basically has said to the cities that she has liberated from the Persians, brilliant, you're now free, pay us tribute instead. And that sets up in antiquity an idea that empire succeeds empire, which you also get in the Bible, because that's what the vision of Daniel, he has a vision of basically empires succeeding one another. So that's a kind of important part of the way that in the West, throughout the ancient, the Christian, the Muslim periods, this idea that there are empires succeeding empires, and depending where you are in that line of succession, the final empire is the one that God wants. Now, there are two... Well, we talked about China as a genius imperial system because it convinces the people who've been conquered by the first emperor that they are complicit in this imperial order. The other genius example is Islam, because Islam emerges over two centuries as an ideology that exists to justify the rule of the Arabs. God has given the Arabs this enormous empire that spreads from the Atlantic pretty much to the walls of China. But there is also a sense in which Islam supplants and undermines Arab rule because it's universalizing and it enables the conquered. It enables slaves. It enables people who might seem inferior to their Arab rulers to say, well, hey, you know, we want to become Muslim too. And by becoming Muslim, you then have a share in the empire. And it ends up that everyone ends up pretty much buying into this imperial ideology. And so what had begun as a kind of classic empire ends up a civilization in which people equate the existence of a caliphate with God's purpose. So that's that's a genius form of imperialism.
And where does it come from?
Yeah.
Well, Christianity also provides scope for empires. There is a reason why Constantine finds Christianity useful. I'm not saying that he converts cynically. I don't think that's true at all. But his successors, with one exception, Julian, that they remain Christian, partly, I think, because they're incredibly devout, but they're devout because they see that it works and that they rule a would-be universal empire, and they are now worshipping a universal God. So, you know, it's very flattering to them. And this idea that Christianity is properly universal is brilliant, again, if you have universal imperial ambitions. Virgil, writing back in the time of Augustus, had written of Rome that the gods had given her imperium sine fine, empire without limit. And this is kind of morally what Christianity offers them. But there is a huge problem for Christian imperialists, which is that the figure of the cross, Jesus on the cross, and the cross becomes the emblem of Christianity. This is a guy who is being tortured to death by the servants and agents of a world empire. And the man on the cross conquers the security apparatus that has nailed him to the cross. And that guy on the cross had said that the last will be first and the first will be last. And this valorization of those who are last, those who are weak, those who are not great conquerors, those who are subjected to the power of an empire, itself becomes a source of power. And it means that running throughout the history of Christian imperialism, with all its universalist ambitions, there is a parallel tradition which says that empire is something evil, and that true virtue lies not with the emperor, but with those who resist the empire. And I think that to that extent, the hostility at the current West to the idea of imperialism is reflective of our deep roots in that Christian tradition. And I would go so far as to say that there is nothing quite so expressive of Western assumptions and a kind of universalist arrogance, if you want to put it like that, nothing more expressive of it than the impulses that lie behind decolonization. Decolonization is the ultimate expression of Western imperialism.
But isn't it also true, and this will go back to my point, that in a way that, you know, the most anti-imperialist piece of writing that the ancient world produces is the Book of Revelation.
It absolutely is, yes. So,
And it isn't just about the virtue of those who suffer, it's about the corruption of those who exercise imperial power.
And it has an amazingly sophisticated understanding of how empire works. So Babylon, Rome is Babylon, but you know, there you have an echo of the abiding influence of the Babylonian Empire, even though the city of Babylon by this point is pretty much ruined. It's a portrait of Babylon as a kind of vampire whore who is sucking the blood out of everybody else in the world and adorning herself with the riches and jewels and splendor that is brought to her as tribute. And there is an understanding that Rome's power is rooted in a kind of economic dominance of shipping lanes, and that wealth, an understanding of that wealth derives from a kind of economic control. And I think that is, again, part... I mean, it's very, very sophisticated. And, again, you can see the influence of that, say, on the Marxist understanding of empire. I mean, it all basically goes back to the New Testament, I think.
Is there anything, Ali,
I was going to bring in a few Persian influences,
I'll
resist the temptation.
But what I was going to say is, is there an anti-imperial tradition that comes out of the Persian Empire?
There is actually a number of anti-imperial traditions. I mean, in terms of actually also come out through Persian Shiism, if you will. I mean, in the Islamic world, and Shiism is a sort of an... is founded in essence as an opposition to the dominant form of Islam in the caliphate, the Sunnism. So that does shape that. But I don't think it's I mean, there is an element of it. There are parallels that can be drawn actually with the Christian tradition in terms of martyrdom and fighting against injustice. But it's interesting how far... I mean, the other parallels that I think are more interesting is the way in which, and I think Tom basically alluded to this in some ways, of the way in which the caliphate and Islam becomes that sort of universalizing non-Arab empire at the end of the day. And the biggest impulse for that, of course, are the Persians, who don't like to be subdued, essentially. I mean, essentially what they do is when they're taken over, the Persians are conquered, by the way, in totality, unlike the Romans, by the invading Arab armies in the 7th century. And when you absorb the entire Sasanian state, the last of the Persian empires within that new Arab caliphate, that comes with a certain consequence. I mean, one of the consequences, you inherit an entire set of administration structures, governance, policy from that Persian tradition. But at the same time, as I think has been said, you know, when you have a dominant race, nationality, whatever you want to call them at the time, who are in Islam and its origins was seen as the religion of the Arabs, what they want to do is they want to basically establish themselves much more firmly as part of a sort of a co-leadership mode and to basically influence those who have come in. So you have this sort of takeover from within, which I find quite interesting. And it absorbs. You see it again with the Mongols, actually, where those who are within, who are the conquered peoples and are the subjected peoples, actually through a sort of a cultural influence and a cultural impact and a very powerful self-confident sense of cultural influence tend to sort of absorb their conquerors. There's a lovely phrase which we have, which I'd like to sort of, which is that captive Persia takes prisoner her conquerors. And I think this is the sort of idea that this does have certain parallels with the sort of Christian domination ultimately of the Roman Empire and the Roman legacy. So it's a sort of an absorption from within. There are parallels, as Helen, as you're saying, you know, in terms of a resistance to the empire. But at the end of the day, I'm sorry to say, I think the Persians see themselves as a very imperial people. So it's very difficult for them to be entirely anti-empire.
I mean, there is another...
They can't get used to it.
Another anti-imperial tradition, which you see in Herodotus and you see in Ibn Khaldun, the great Muslim historian, which is the idea that empire is something that is morally sapping. That to be a great imperial power is inherently corrupting, and that you will end up kind of decadent. And the pattern is that you are a kind of rough, tough, nomadic power. You wear leather trousers. You jump onto horses. Absolutely brilliant. You're fit. You're strong. You're hungry, and you're scouting around the edges of these kind of soft, rich empires.
Yeah.
And you find that they're weak, they're soft and hopeless because they're all just going to baths and having sherbet or whatever. And so you pour in with your leather chaps and your big muscles, and you conquer these empires, and you then become the ruling dynasty. And over the course of the decades that follow, you start to develop a taste for baths and for sherbet and so on. And before you know it, another load of guys, leather chaps, are coming in and ruling and taking you over. And this is a cycle that, you know, as I say, the Greeks and the Arabs both recognize it. And there's a sense in which it's there in Rome as well. So there is a pre-Christian Roman anti-imperial tradition, which has very similar notions, and it's best embodied by Tacitus, the greatest of Roman historians, who laments the existence of the empire because he feels that it's led to corruption and autocracy. And he notoriously looks to the Germans as an example of a free people. The Romans have not been able to conquer the Germans because the Germans have maintained their primal liberty. And the reason that this idea is notorious is because it's a huge influence on the Nazis.
What happens then, if that's a story of Eurasian empire, and we can say that for a long time, I think where the Middle East is concerned, you might say this continues, maybe if we take China's empire, that's true too, that we have a succession of land empires, including the cycle of the nomads coming, becoming corrupt, the next
decadence.
Empire arises, yeah, through via decadence.
Proper decadence.
What happens though when some of the West European countries decide that they're going to have oceanic empires?
Well,
do we move into a completely different phase of world history at that point?
I think so. And in terms of so I think obviously that there are what we might recognize as empires coagulate over the course of the Middle Ages. So you might say that England is an empire, that the United Kingdom of England consists of, you know, various Anglo-Saxon kingdoms and parts of the Danelaw and Cornwall, and it all gets kind of absorbed in. And the same could be said of France as well, or indeed of Spain. But people in these kingdoms are kind of operating under the same rules. They're all Christian. They all have they share certain basic assumptions, cultural assumptions. But when, say, the Spanish cross the Atlantic and they reach the Empire of the Aztecs or the Empire of the Incas or whatever, and they conquer them and swallow them up, this then imposes quite stressful moral questions on the conquerors. So on the one hand, there is this kind of idea, brilliant, God has given us this land, let's get all the gold, fabulous. And it's this that underpins the idea of the kind of the black legend of Spanish rule, which is particularly promoted by the Protestant English. And I think the Spanish justifiably say it's a bit rich. but conversely, there is equally a very, very Spanish tradition that says, whoa, what are we doing? I mean, you know, we can't treat these conquered people just as slaves or animals because, they are God's creatures. We have to, we have to treat them as people created like us in the image of God. And so within decades of Columbus's arrival in the New World, people are having this debate about whether empire is morally acceptable or not. And there are those who say, of course it's acceptable. God has given it to us. It's brilliant. We can use our power to spread the word, the gospel, and take loads of gold at the same time. And at the same time, there are people saying, oh, no, this is a real problem. We shouldn't be doing this. It's evil. It's corrupting. And I think that's what I mean when I say that decolonization is an index of European imperialism, because this is a notion that, say, the Aztecs would not have had, the Incas would not have had. The Aztecs and Incas take completely for granted their right to conquer other peoples, but it's the Spanish, it's the Dominicans and the Franciscans and then the Jesuits who are making the case to Spanish warlords that there's something really problematic with that. And that tradition, of course, also exists in the Protestant empires. It exists in what becomes the British Empire and in America.
I mean, there's no moral doubt in the... Don't worry.
No. I was gonna...
it is interesting because, I mean, as Tom was speaking, I mean, I was thinking, going back to your previous question, Helen, actually, I mean, there isn't... You don't get the literature of self-doubt. Mm. You know, there is a right way and a wrong way. Yeah, or actually in the Middle East or Eurasia, whatever. I mean, basically, there's a right way and the wrong way. The right way is God's way or the moral way and whatever, and this is it. There's no tradition, there's no literature of that saying, oh, you know, this is terrible, should we be doing this?
Well, Ali, I always remember you giving me the letter written by a Persian prince. The 1850s, when the British are embarking on their campaign to abolish slavery, and he's utterly bewildered, isn't he?
He's bewildered. Partly.
Why are they doing this?
I know.
It's such an odd thing to be doing.
But there is at a certain point a new language of resisting empires that comes along, and that's the idea of the nation.
That's right.
I don't think it was actually articulated for the first time in France, but that is the general accepted narrative that it comes with the French Revolution. And
except, that very ideology then justifies Napoleon in conquering
America. Yes, absolutely.
Nonetheless, but it is regardless of whether it's used as an imperial strategy, it gives a language to those who want to resist imperial rule, starting, one would say, in Europe.
Or in the Caribbean.
In Haiti, in the Ottomans. Against Ottoman rule and in Greece in particular. And then you could tell a story that says, well, that language then spreads through the rest of Eurasia in the 19th century.
I mean, the relationship between empire and nation is a fascinating one. I mean, for me, it's one of the key things that I like to look at in terms of even the Middle East. Because if you look at the Ottoman Empire and the collapse and dismemberment of the Ottoman Empire and its replacement by various states, nation or otherwise, there is an open question about whether the dissolution of the Ottoman Empire was a good thing. Now, that's possibly a controversial.
No,
but I have to say, you know, it's an interesting debate, certainly, that people have, that, you know, we have assumed that the nation, let's put that in inverted commas, since we do live in a world of United Nations, as everyone reminds us, that the nation is the right way in which people should be politically organised. And that's really a consequence of the post of the 20th century and the Great War and others. But I suppose, just to put it out, you know, and hopefully it'll give you some food for thought questions, is it?
I mean, I think, you mentioned the French Revolution. I think that there is a massive, massive tension in the ideology of the French Revolution from the beginning. And in a way, it's a kind of inheritance from the Christianity that is giving, but that is influencing it. But in the Declaration of the Rights of Man and of the Citizen, which is issued about 6 weeks after the fall of the Bastille, you have these 17 kind of rights that the drafters of this kind of preamble to the new constitution for France have drawn up. And the first one says that human rights are universal. Everyone has a right to them. You know, they've always existed. They are everywhere. Mm. And then the third one says that there is no source for the law but the nation. And, you know, that is obviously pointing at the king. It's saying, actually, you know, law doesn't come from the king, it comes from the nation. But the idea that human rights are simultaneously universal and for everyone, and at the same time that it's the nation that guarantees them, sets up a massive, massive tension within certainly European understandings of how geopolitics should be ordered. And because Europe is so hegemonic in the 19th century and into the 20th century, and then with America, you know, even into the 21st century, it's had a seismic impact on the non-Western world as well. And I would say that, you know, Ali, your point that there's a case for saying that the collapse of the Ottoman Empire, certainly in the Middle East, was a disaster. The case for making that is that the Ottoman Empire stands in a line of succession that goes back to the ancient Persian Empire. Mm. It's a kind of would-be universalist empire that claims a divine sanction for itself, that justifies its rule of the world in terms of the order that it provides to all the constituent peoples within this imperium. And that is then kind of dissolved and undermined by this French revolutionary idea that law and right derives from the nation. Because in the context of the Ottoman Empire, it's not immediately obvious what that means. Mm. And it comes to be ethnically based. And so you see over the course of the 20th century, and you see it in India as well, terrible processes of ethnic cleansing. So you see, you know, Greeks being expelled from what becomes Turkey, and they've been there for 3,000 years. You see Turks being expelled from Crete and from northern Greece. You see Jews being expelled from cities that, again, places in Mesopotamia, in Iraq. Jews had been there since, you know, for 2,500 years, and they're all being expelled and going to try and make their homeland. As they're making their homeland, Palestinians are being expelled, and really, the crisis in Israel and Gaza at the moment is merely an expression of processes that have been ongoing since the Ottoman Empire began collapsing.
I agree with that, but what I want to press you on, Tom, is, and both of you on, is if we take Europe, not the Middle East for the moment,
sure,
what was the basis in which the Ottoman Empire could have survived? Once you put together Christianity, the Greek heritage going back to what the idea of Athens was, plus the French Revolution, can you really see a scenario in which Ottoman Europe continued through the 20th century?
I think had the Ottomans not been sucked into the meat grinder of the First World War, you could imagine that they might have survived. I mean, one of the reasons why Russia mobilizes and thereby precipitates the First World War is anxiety that the Ottomans are getting back. The Ottomans actually have just commissioned two dreadnoughts from Britain. Mm-hmm. They have a fleet that is much larger than the Russian fleet in the Black Sea. And so again, there are kind of contemporary resonances in this.
And you think they could have retaken Greece?
No, I don't think they could have done that. But I think that had they stayed out of the First World War, they a shattered European continent, you know, whoever ended up winning the First World War, their exhaustion would have been such that they would have been in no mood to kind of embark on attempting to carve up the Ottoman Empire in the Middle East, I think.
I mean, let me ask you a question, Helen. Do you think that the dissolution of the Austro-Hungarian Empire was a bad thing?
I think that...
Do you think that could have survived?
I think that you could tell a story which says without the First World War, it could have survived.
Yeah.
But, and I've put a really big but into that, the bit of it that doesn't add up is the Hungary part of it.
Right.
And they'd already had to make a huge compromise in 1867 with the dual monarchy. I think that once you've let loose the idea of the nation and tied it to the language of the French Revolution, because I think there are nations and a sense of imagined community around the nation that long pre-exists the French Revolution, but it supercharges it.
Persia being one.
Yeah, England being another.
Yeah.
It supercharges it. And once it's let loose in the world, I think it's an extraordinarily potent idea, because if you take the Austro-Hungarian Empire, even just when it's the Austrian Empire, the Austrians are very keen on the idea that it's not a nation, that the Austrians aren't a nation, that they're not nationalist. But it is. It's just Greater Austria.
Yeah.
It's just Austrian nation. It's just the Austrian nation being good, and other parts of the empire being barbarian.
Well, could I also ask a question, which is Helen, as an analyst of contemporary geopolitics, who's never knowingly cheery, do you see empires existing at the moment? And if you do, do you see them on the march?
I mean, I think that there are surviving empires in the world. I think China is an historical empire. I think Russia is most clearly still an empire, and still not only
United States
acts an empire, acts like an empire, but has its leaders have an acutely imperial mindset. I think the United States was historically formed as an empire. The difference between the United States and Russia is that its continental conquest was justified successfully, legitimated perhaps successfully, by the idea of creating Americans, and the Russians were never able to do that in their continental conquest.
I mean, it's interesting when you go back to the Ottomans, and that's it, the Ottomans did try to create an Ottoman nation, and it clearly failed, and as Tom says, they separated on ethnic lines. You know, the Arabs and the Turks went their separate ways. And partly had to do with language, of course. I mean, Ottoman Turkish is notoriously difficult. It's not really a language that you can do sort of mass education and sort of educate your public with.
Unlike Farsi.
And that's the interesting point, actually. And there is an interesting point there, that if you look at the Ottoman Empire and the Persian, what I like to call it in the 19th century is like an imperial kingdom, if I can put it that way, because it's not really, it's sort of halfway between one and the other. But what's very interesting is the ability of the Persian intellectuals, unlike their Ottoman colleagues, to manage a transition away from an imperial state into what we might term a national state. Now, note, I don't say nation state. Okay, I actually think, I mean, one of the great fictions of our day, I think, I don't know if you agree, actually, Helen, but let me just say, is that I think that there are very few, if any, nation states, as in those that coincide with the political organisation they're in. There are very many national states, as in those who promote a particular vision. Some are more successful than others. I think the most successful national states are obviously in Europe for various reasons, but there are some exceptions around the world. We now come in, obviously, the term that is very popular these days, which is sort of like a bit of a fiction to try and excuse the idea of empire, is the civilizational state. So we now have civilizational states as if, and this is, China is not an empire, it's a civilizational state. Well, okay, it gives a certain number of academics a lot of things to do, but it's an extra article. but I do think, and there may be some value to that term, and let me hold my hands up, I've used it myself. But I do think it's partly a reflection of the fact that everyone's so allergic to using the term empire that they then have invented a new category and a new term for themselves.
I guess we should
go to
open
questions.
Oh, I think we have
questions. Can I just ask you, Helen, one other question, which is if we go back to this idea that initially imperium meant power that could be exercised over other people. And I guess you would argue that power, I mean, it kind of depends on energy and the ability to marshal resources and so on. And my sense would be, from knowing your cheery take on all this, is that Europe is not in a good position when it comes to exercising imperium power in the way that it used to. Does that then mean that Europe, Britain, whatever, will become subject to the imperium of imperial states, of great powers, even in the original Roman sense, rather than, you know, I don't think we'll be kind of formally absorbed into an empire and be painted pink, but that effectively our national independence will be lost to the exercise of power by a greater power?
I think that most of Europe's fate is sort of going in that direction. If you think of the United States and China as two historically formed empires, and that we will be in the economic orbit of
one or the other,
or the more likely perhaps the ongoing competition.
Because people sometimes talk about the European Union as an empire, but you think that it hasn't really got what it takes to be an empire in the way that China or America.
I think it's very difficult to imagine any empire that doesn't have geopolitical power.
Yeah.
And the European Union doesn't have geopolitical power.
Brilliant. Fun times.
Any questions?
Sure not.
With microphones. Okay, now that's a lot to choose from. Okay, we're going to start. We start with the man with the blue shirt. There's actually two of you. The one with the hand, your hand the highest. We'll start there.
The one with the imperium.
Yes, I think you might have hinted at your last answer, but do you think we let large organisations act as empires, a la Facebook? And do you think we'll look differently at them in the future?
Ali can answer.
I mean, I'm far from an expert on this, but because I had originally asked Helen, I do think that one of the ways in which we're looking at imperial hegemony, if you will, and the control over our modern lives in that sense, our lives today, is through these technology companies that are universal, effectively. I mean, to the extent that you're getting Apple and Google and others saying, we are not American companies, we're global companies. And, yes, they'll obviously subscribe to certain laws, but at the end of the day, they don't see themselves as beholden to that particular political state. And one can understand that, of course, when it comes to privacy and issues like that. But it's actually more problematic when, I suppose, you are in a confrontational or a competition-like state with China and others who will have their own companies who will be doing certain things. And it's always that question mark. But there is an argument now that the new empires are really these technology empires. And those are the ones that are basically now, in an interesting way, a subtle and somewhat invisible way, controlling all our lives, actually. I mean, we have all lived, actually, in the last 25 years through an extraordinary revolution, and most of us haven't noticed.
Yeah. Next, we'll take two at a time, this thing.
Brilliant, thank you. Brilliant conversation. I wonder whether the embarrassment about empire was sort of the ghost. Well, we didn't mention the British Empire, well, barely. It was the ghost at the feast. And I wonder why did
I thought that was pretty good, actually.
Last so briefly? Was it a failure of power, of money, of politics, or was it a failure of culture and of its ability to persuade the conquered people, because they certainly tried, to be part of the Greater Britain?
Okay, any more? Have I got this? Okay, while we're waiting, Tom, do you want to take that one?
I mean, I think the British Empire is pretty ephemeral relative to some of the other empires that we've been talking about. And I think that what was distinctive about it was that it was bred of the weird fact that for a fleeting while, Britain had a kind of superpower relative to everywhere else, because it industrialized first. And the the great focus of that process of industrialization were the naval dockyards. So there's a brilliant description of them as being 19th century islands in an 18th century sea. And it's that, essentially, it's the ability of Britain to project itself across the oceans and to exercise a kind of technological superiority that no one could rival, that I think essentially led to the creation of the empire, because the reason for controlling the shipping lanes is to enable stuff to be transported on the shipping lanes. And to do that, you need kind of nodes, you need Gibraltars or Maltas or whatever, but you also need you need lands that can give you the goods. And we've just been talking about corporations and are they imperial? And it's, you know, it's not the British state that embarks on the conquest of India. It's a private company, and basically the British Empire. The famous comment on it is that it's accumulated in
an absence of mind.
I mean, I think that's overdone, but it's clearly it's a kind of patchwork, and it's not. There's no real coherence there. The most enduring legacies of the British Empire, of course, are the settler empires. So Australia, New Zealand, United States, thought of as part of the Anglosphere, and Canada, and so on. And they are enduring, I think. And there are clearly very significant legacies of British imperial power, not least which is the use of English, and the fact that the habits of European thought are pretty much taken for granted in large swathes of the world that would define themselves as anti-colonial. Because I think to be overtly and self-consciously anti-colonial is to bear the stamp of European colonialism.
Can I just add something? And you'd be disappointed if I didn't put oil into at least one answer. Is that by the time that you get to the beginning of the 20th century, and that Britain is looking to extend its empire in the Middle East and at least have a sphere of influence in Persia, the resource that they want, oil, is so crucial that it creates intense imperial competition from other states, not just from Europe, but from Japan too. And that competition is part of the story of the First World War, it's part of the story of the Second World War, and then those wars very much hasten Britain's imperial fall. So I think that once you change the energy resource to oil and you actually have imperial competition around that, then the chances of any empire lasting for very long are actually much reduced because the competition's too intense. Okay.
Lady in the...
Yeah.
Thank you. This time last year, Peter Frankopan gave a very powerful talk about the impact of changing climate on the history of the rise and fall of nations and civilizations, and he talked about his book, the title of which I've forgotten. So my question really is, given the competition for resources, the challenge, potentially existential challenge to the ordering of nations with climate change ahead, what could you say potentially about how the current power balances might be affected?
Helen, this is so yours.
This is really you, yeah.
The World Transformed, I think, is Peter's book.
Yes.
I think that you have to start thinking about that question in terms of the parts of the world that are going to be most rapidly and most intensely impacted by climate change. And one part of the world that is the Middle East. In fact, it already is. Iraq's a very good example of that, I think. So what we're seeing there is in the part of the world where empires have never gone away, the Middle Eastern story is not the European story, and where you have competition about the very idea of how to have territorial organization from the caliphate to the nation state to whatever we think of Iran as having under the Islamic Republic, certainly territorially expansionist in mindset. Once you then add in the effects, not just ecologically, but in humanitarian terms, of climate change into that, that is going to matter in terms of the relationship between the power structure and the climate change immensely, what the outcome of it is going to be and whether that would lead to a new form of empire in the Middle East, who I wouldn't know. I wouldn't want to speculate, but part of that will be if parts of the Middle East become essentially inhabitable, then where do the populations that are moved out of those places end up? What kind of rule in any other state would they accept? I mean, that's a lot of things that you're putting together in that part of the world. And I think the fact that the question of how you actually organize politics territorially has never been resolved in the Middle East, even in a kind of the illusion that it was perhaps in the West and from the 1990s, the end of history moment, really complicates the question even more.
I mean, I think that whether it's the Great Wall of China or Hadrian's Wall or this the earliest known wall that was built to guard the flank of Syria, I think maybe 3000 BC, rich, powerful and prosperous entities have always felt a need to defend themselves against people who want to have a share in it. And it's inevitable that at periods of climate change or of famine or of disease or whatever, that that will result in pressure on the borders of empires. And I suppose to that extent, you could say that maybe the European Union to that extent is an empire, that it's having to negotiate. How do you deal with people who are coming from places that are being ravaged by climate change or war, or wars that are influenced by climate change, can the values of the European Union be maintained while also maintaining the integrity of its frontiers? And that is, I imagine, a question on which you have a typically cheery attitude.
I would say just on that, well, you can see it in action in terms of the ongoing enlargement of the European Union, whether it will be possible for it to keep getting bigger going eastward. That involves not just the Ukraine question, but the Georgia question. And what you can see, and this is a bit imperial in that sense, is a contest between Russia and the European Union over the border country of Georgia.
And the kind of imperial struggle over those Caucasus regions. I mean, the Romans and the Persians are doing it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's amazing. It's so timeless. And you read accounts in, I don't know, Livy about Roman plenipotentiaries and Parthian ambassadors scrapping over Armenia or wherever. Yeah. And you just think, wow, you know, geography determines
so much. But the
European
Union is not the Roman Empire.
No, although Giorgia Meloni, perhaps.
Giorgia Meloni, yeah.
We've got time for a couple more questions. I'm going to take one, this person in the grey shirt, and then there's the woman in the sunglasses with her. Are you trying to point? Okay.
The younger boy.
You first, and then there.
So there've been a couple of references to decolonization, and we've got two people from within the academy and one outside. So I just wondered if you could comment on the evolution of the debate around empire within the universities in the context of conversations around culture wars and everything else. So be interested in the perspective from within the academy and outside of the academy on that.
Okay, and the other next question? Last.
What I wondered was, in the next few centuries and possibly the next millennia, do you think there are any countries that, once they have inevitably collapsed in the next few centuries, will be referred to as empires?
Russia.
Question.
Yeah. The Academy.
Oh, the Academy. No, you can start with the Academy.
There's no doubt that
I'll defer to Cambridge on this.
Yeah, there's no doubt that there has been a discussion over the last probably started about a decade ago now, in the language of decolonizing the curriculum that simply wasn't there. I arrived in Cambridge in 1994. It wasn't something that was discussed. I mean, one of the first things that I did when I took over the first year politics paper in Cambridge was to introduce Gandhi's Hind Swaraj as a set text into that paper, but it never occurred to me that I was decolonizing the curriculum doing that. Now we have a lot of discussion about what set texts that there are, that this has to be part of the language of the debate that we have internally about these texts. There's some good things about that, in the sense that it makes you think through why you're teaching what you're teaching more carefully. There's some not so good things about that, in the sense that it can be introducing content into a paper or changing it for the sake of changing it, rather than because there's actually a good pedagogical reason for doing that. And I mean, I'm not surprising anybody, I'm sure, by saying this, it's quite divisive, because different people have very different views about it. And it's divisive sometimes between the students and the academic staff. It's divisive between the academic staff, and it's divisive between the students. You shouldn't underestimate that part of it as well.
I think, I mean, I there's always value, obviously, in reviewing syllabuses and, you know, checking to see how relevant things are. But I think my objection to what has been going on in some cases, certainly, is that the process of decolonization of the syllabus or whatever it is actually an act of colonization in itself. I mean, this is the absurdity of it. And to go back to what we were discussing earlier, you know, those who seek to decolonize certain things do it with such a moral certitude that you would embarrass you. I mean, I've never seen the confidence with which they proceed. And it's
But you would have done in a previous Christian era.
Yes. I think it refers back to
my perspective outside the academy is that it's sublimated Christianity.
Yes. I mean, I tend to agree with Tom on that. Yeah.
So just to answer the question about how the present day might look in a kind of imperial context in, say, 300 years' time, I think one of the key ways that our imagination in the West is conditioned by the past is the fact that we live in a world that was once ruled by an empire that declined and fell. So unlike the Chinese. That sense that empires rise and then they fall, we tend to see it as a kind of law of almost, you know, Newtonian physics. And so Edward Gibbon was inspired to write The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire by going to the Forum and witnessing the spectacle of the utter collapse of the great civilization that had once stood there. And because of that, there is an incredible sense of anxiety that will be inevitable in a capital city that has been founded by people who had modeled their infant republic on the example of the Roman Republic and had set up a Capitol Hill and a Senate. And that's why in science fiction films or zombie films or whatever, again and again, you will have the spectacle of the ruins of Washington evoking the idea of the ruins of ancient Rome. It's very, very powerful and deeply rooted. So I imagine that the place that is best suited to serve as a monument to fallen imperial dreams, a kind of Ozymandias city, would be Washington. And on that note, we should probably end.
I was going to say this.
Can I say one thing before you go? And I just want to thank you all for not having once mentioned Alexander the Great. Thank God.